Hear that? Yeah, that's the sound of you relaxing, because now you're managing diabetes with the Freestyle Libre 3 system. You get to know your glucose levels and where it's headed. Manage your diabetes with more confidence with the Freestyle Libre 3 system. Ready to learn more about the number one prescribed CGM in the U.S.? Visit freestylelibre.us to learn more. Based on retail sales data for patients last filled prescription by manufacturer, refer to the FLAIR NL4 study published in BMJ Open Diabetes Research and Care 2019. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Hello, it's another episode of Heretics, and today, well, this was part of my tour, a big tour. Well, it was just a trip to New York, Dissident Dialogues. That's the event at which I spoke, organised by Winston Marshall, previously of Mumford & Sons. And I managed to secure a studio where I interviewed quite a few guests, many of whom were of the American variety. But this particular guest, although she appears to live in the continent of North America, is British, and that is Mia Hughes, who is a researcher for environmental progress, but also famously, or infamously, depending on what side of the what would you call it, the culture wars that you're on, she is the author of the WPATH files. So she is the person who managed to sort of put together a lot of these files around doctors who were giving surgeries and things to children, to young girls and things, fully in the knowledge that this was not going to help them, or it might not help them, and that these children didn't fully understand what they were going for, and that this was not going to be reversible. It was a really incredible and scary release of files and documents, and some great journalism. This is what journalism is for. So Mia's brilliant on that. And she also, I know I've done quite a few episodes on gender and things like that before, but there's a lot in here that I've not previously covered, and she's really good about it. And we talk really about whether transgenderism is a mental health issue, in which case could it be described as a mental illness. I know a lot of people will find that offensive, but a thing is a thing is a thing, you know. And she believes very strongly and has a very good case for why that might be, and how we really should be treating people with this condition, or as she will call it, a mental illness. So I hope you find it of interest. Please do follow her on _CryMia, the name Mia River, on X, and just sort of follow all her stuff. She's really, really good. It was great talking to her. And I hope you find this of intrigue. I'll see you at the end. Mia Hughes, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What made you want to expose concerns around gender?
Oh, goodness. So I discovered the issue in 2019. I can tell you the exact date. It was December 19th, 2019. That's the day that J.K. Rowling wrote her infamous, now infamous tweet. I think it was the first time she had weighed into the trans issue publicly. And it was on that day that I realized what was happening. I was going along with trans women are women before that point, not because I believed it, but because I thought it was the kind thing to do. And I couldn't see the harm. And on the day that J.K. Rowling tweeted was the day that I realized we were supposed to believe that trans women were women. I didn't think any of us really believed it. I thought we were all just pretending. So when I realized that we were supposed to believe trans women are women, that's when I stopped pretending that I believed it. And I saw the way she was attacked, and I was looking at all of these threads and looking at everything that was happening on Twitter. And on that day, I discovered the concept of the male lesbian. I'm sure you've come across this concept. I still can't believe that it's real, but there really are people out there who believe there's such a thing as a male lesbian. That's the most ludicrous thing in the world to me. But then shortly after that, I discovered what's happening to children and teenagers in gender clinics. I learned that children are being taught that they can be born in the wrong body. I learned that teenagers are being chemically castrated. They're having healthy body parts chopped off. And from that point on, I couldn't look away. So I started tweeting. I had a tiny Twitter account. I started tweeting about it right away and ended up with a whole career as a journalist and researcher.
That lesbian thing, and I got to sort of credit Ryan Long. Do you know Ryan Long? Is a Canadian. I know you live in Canada. Can we say you live in Canada? Mm-hmm. Some people don't want to say what country they're in. Ryan Long, he's really funny. And he did that video. You might have seen it. It went quite viral. That was woke people and racists agree on the same stuff.
Right. Yes, I did see that.
And it was hilarious. Really funny. They did it like they're in love with each other. It's like, we both think this and that. That was great. But he did another skit or whatever after the October 7th Israel stuff. And he was like, oh, you know, what? Pretending to be a social media person going, what should I do? Which one do I side with? Right. What's going to get me more likes and clicks and things? Let's see what the UN have to say. Mm-hmm. And the UN tweeted, trans lesbians are lesbians. That was what they thought about October 7th. How remarkable is that? I mean, does that typify just how much this sort of dogma has seeped into a very mainstream culture?
Very much so. I mean, it's captured everything. This ideology, this crazy, insane ideology that has no grounding in reality, has captured every layer of society, every institution, every, you know, it's in schools, it's in mainstream media, it's everywhere. And it's utterly absurd, really, truly. The fact that anybody could believe there's such a thing as a male lesbian, it's like a 1970s comedy club homophobic joke brought to life. I'm endlessly baffled.
What was it, for those who don't know, I think a lot do now, but what was it that J.K. Rowling, I mean, you can paraphrase what she tweeted.
Right, I should have it imprinted in my mind. She was tweeting in support of Maya Forstater,
yes,
who was a tax consultant, and she had lost her job basically for saying men are not women or something like that. JK tweeted, it was a lovely tweet. It was something like, dress however you like, sleep with whatever consenting adult will have you, live your best life, or whatever, but to... something about a woman getting fired for saying sex is real. It was just a tweet in support of Maya, because JK was obviously very upset that Maya had taken it to an employment tribunal and had lost her case because the judge ruled that her belief that sex is real is not worthy of respect in a democratic society, which is completely outrageous.
Man. So this is a controversial thing to even ask now, but is there any evidence to support the idea that you can be in the wrong body or that gender exists outside of sex in some tangible way?
There's absolutely not one shred of scientific evidence to support the existence of gender identities. It's a belief. It's just a belief. It's like belief in a religious belief in souls. It's a belief. The reason that they framed it in this way, this idea that it's a gender identity that makes you a man, a woman, a boy, or a girl, is because they decided to depathologize being transgender, which means they made it so that being transgender or gender dysphoria was not a mental illness. It was a perfectly natural, healthy state of being. And so because it obviously is a mental illness, it's obviously a psychiatric disorder, but we're not allowed to talk about that. So we instead have to pretend that we believe in these gender identities. And therefore, if you have a mismatched gender identity, that's perfectly natural and healthy and we should celebrate it. But when you do that, when you celebrate the mismatched gender identity, you don't help the person. You're not denying the existence of the mental illness doesn't help those who suffer from the mental illness. It all it does is prevent them from getting the necessary care. And instead, because you can't help the person overcome the mental illness, all you now can do is give them hormones and surgeries to fix the mismatch, the misalignment. So not only are you not helping them with their mental distress, but you're also putting them on a very harsh, brutal, experimental treatment pathway that is going to probably make their life a whole lot worse.
So I haven't heard it put exactly like that, because this is a question about whether it's a mental illness or not, that even many of us who are talking about it or who would call themselves gender critical are maybe shying away from saying. I've maybe shied away from even publicly saying it, even though I've been going through my mind, well, is this a mental illness? What even is a mental illness? Would you then say that transgenderism is a mental illness?
I would say that you've got gender dysphoria is the diagnosis in the DSM. That's the American Psychiatric Association's Bible, basically the diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders. It's gender dysphoria there. It's gender incongruence in the World Health Organization's International Classification of Diseases. Whatever you want to call it, it is obviously a mental illness. It is obviously a psychiatric disorder. You cannot believe yourself to be a member of the opposite sex and not have a mental illness. It's clearly a mental disorder. You can't hate your body so much that you shower with the light off if you don't have a mental illness. This is not a sign of good mental health to hate your body so much that you can't even look at it with the light on. It's not a sign of good mental health for a man to want his penis inverted and turned into an open wound that he has to dilate for the rest of his life. That's not evidence of a sound mind. The reason that we're forbidden, the reason they went on this de-psychopathologization campaign, which was WPATH, which is the organization that I wrote the report about, the reason that they did that is they wanted to destigmatize transgender identities. I understand that. I understand that there is a stigma attached to being mentally ill, I suppose. But the answer is not to deny the existence of the mental illness. The answer is to work on reducing the stigma. Because, you know, if let's say there's a stigma attached to being schizophrenic, the answer is not to deny the existence of schizophrenia. Mm. That would not help schizophrenic people at all. And so the same thing goes with gender-related issues. We have got to start, we've got to go back to, I call it the re-pathologization. We've got to re-pathologize. We've got to face, we've just got to look at the truth of the matter, that it is a difficult mental disorder and these people need help. I don't necessarily think that help should come in the form of hormones and surgeries.
What do you think will happen if I title this video something along the lines that, suggesting that trans is a mental illness?
I have a feeling that YouTube would not like it very much. Mm. And I'm certain that trans activists won't like it. But at this point, you see, denying that it's a mental illness, on the one hand, it's just bad for anyone who suffers from the mental illness. It's not good for them. But on the other hand, when you deny that it's a mental illness, then you deny that we've got an epidemic on our hands. And we have an epidemic on our hands. It's a psychiatric epidemic. It's very obvious. It's spread through the adolescent and young adult population. And so by denying that it's a mental illness, you're also denying the epidemic. And that's a very dangerous place to be, because that's how we've ended up with all of these kids spend like 5 minutes on trans TikTok and you'll see the girls parading, prancing around with their mastectomy scars. This has all happened because we were not allowed to speak the truth about this issue. We were not allowed to say what we could see with our own eyes. And it's, we should no longer be afraid of offending trans activists, because look where that's got us.
For the sake of just the audience, what does epidemic actually mean in that sense? And do we have evidence that it has become one?
Well, I mean, an epidemic, when numbers explode, I mean, we've all lived through a pandemic now, so we all understand exponential growth on a graph. We're all quite good at that. And so if you just have to take one look at a graph that plots referrals to pediatric gender clinics, every graph looks the same. So up until around 2013, 2014, the numbers are quite level. It's, you know, it's low. And then all of a sudden around 2014, you see the exponential growth. It shoots up on... Not just in the UK, it's in the UK, it's in Canada, it's in the US, Sweden, everywhere where there is a graph that shows the referrals to pediatric gender clinics shows the exact same exponential growth. When that happens, you have to ask why. And in any other branch of medicine, doctors would ask why. If you saw a sudden 5,000% increase in young people with bipolar disorder, the mental health world would investigate immediately what is happening, what is causing this, what can we do about it. If you saw a 5,000% increase in girls suffering from anorexia, immediately we would want to know what was that trigger, what is causing this. And yet with gender, the 5,000% increase happens and nobody says a thing. Everybody's pretending that it's perfectly normal and healthy. Why? Because it's gender. You're not allowed to question anything. You can only celebrate. It's almost as if we were supposed to celebrate a 5,000% increase in teenage girls showing up at gender clinics wanting their breasts cut off.
I suppose they would argue that society got to a place where, and that it's not a mental illness, and society got to a place where this was acceptable and finally they're able to be free.
Yeah, that's exactly what they argue. And that falls apart completely, first and foremost, because if you look at the graph, it's concentrated on teenage girls. I think the peak age is from age 13 to 15 or something like that. If we were talking societal acceptance, we would be seeing across the board, we would be seeing an increase in numbers in, I don't know, children, boys and girls, teenage boys and girls, young adults, male and female, your grown men, grown women, you know, basically, where are all the 40-year-old women lining up to get shots of testosterone and have their breasts cut off now that society will finally accept them for the men that they always were? They don't exist. Where are all of the, well, I mean, okay, there are men, middle-aged men, now more and more middle-aged men, I think, seeking gender transition, but that is another category entirely. But the reason we know it's an epidemic, we know it's a social contagion, is because every social contagion throughout history, teenage girls have been at the forefront. Mm. Teenage girls and young women, they have been the ones that have been affected by almost every social contagion all throughout history. And they are the ones that are front and center in this one. And as well, you see it, I mean, I live in Ottawa. I heard a story, a high school in Ottawa, there are 5 trans-identified girls who think they are boys in one high school class. Now, that's statistically impossible if we are talking a randomly occurring innate trait that you know, you just wouldn't, like, I think 5 in one class, you simply wouldn't see that. It's so obviously social contagion. It's exactly, we saw it with eating disorders, we saw it with anorexia, we saw it with bulimia, we saw it with cutting. these things have occurred throughout recent history, and yet we turn a blind eye to the one that is staring us right in the face.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen, and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in 4 of their best selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup: 2 carry on sizes, 2 checked sizes, 4 colours, black, blue, pink, grey. Made from a high strength nylon, the bag is tear resistant as well as weather resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded, both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favourite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
What you're talking about, I believe I've seen, I think it was Kathleen Stock talking about with Japan, that they didn't have any anorexia. Like, this just wasn't a thing there. That's and hard. Then American movies began being exported. It might have been Helen Joyce, but I think it was Kathleen Stock. The movies got over there and then suddenly everybody had it over there. I used to live in Argentina where, again, teenage girls, it's the same demographic, and with them they don't have the same thing of, well, they do now, but the trans thing wasn't so big there, so for them it was exorcism, right? And we as a society, in Western society, we laugh at this idea that these people, they have something, they can't explain what it is, they obviously feel not in control of their bodies, they are being looked at by boys and men, they don't know what to do, you know, they've lost a sense of control and they think there's something inside them that needs to be taken out, which to me is, in Western society, is the gendered soul. Over there, it's a demon. And I saw these young girls, it was girl after girl after girl, always 17 years old, 16 years old, go through these processes and have the demon out. And then I was like, how do you feel now? And they were like, fantastic, I'm great. A year later, back to square one. And now they're getting like multiple exorcisms. They're going to churches where like there's loads of priests and loads of exorcised girls. It's nuts. And we're laughing at it and then going, hang on, so what's your inside you and what's your outside you? They must be laughing at us.
Goodness me, we cannot laugh at any other culture, for sure. It's the rest of the world must be looking on in absolute horror at what we are allowing to happen to these girls. But I mean, you're right, like I think the example you were talking about with anorexia is Hong Kong. Uh-huh. There was a case of a schoolgirl collapsed on the street in Hong Kong and died. And it turned out she had starved herself to death. And it was the media frenzy around her death. And they interviewed Western psychiatrists, Western mental health experts who said she had died of anorexia, the Western type of anorexia. And then there was an epidemic of anorexia in Hong Kong. It's not even complicated. The effect of these events, the effect of these eating disorders or these psychiatric disorders being portrayed in the media, it just plants the idea into a vulnerable mind. So we've got this concept, I love the concept of the symptom pool. This is a medical historian, Edward Shorter, came up with it. And so he says that throughout, in all cultures, there exists a symptom pool of legitimate mental illnesses that your culture views as being a legitimate way to express your mental distress. And so in the symptom pool of our time, there exists gender dysphoria. So if you are an adolescent girl and you hate your body and you don't fit in with your peers and you are, maybe you've been a victim of a sexual assault and you're, whatever, you're in a bad place, you are not happy, and you don't know why, and you're looking for an answer. Why do I feel so terrible? You can turn to the symptom pool of your time and you can select gender dysphoria. And the reason that gender dysphoria is, I think, so dangerous is because in the past, you know, she could have selected, well, she still can select anorexia, mm-hmm. bulimia, which are very bad behaviors to select and to apply to your life. She could have selected multiple personality disorder mm-hmm. in the 1980s. She could have selected hysteria in the late 19th century.
Exorcism.
Exactly. But now the problem with gender dysphoria is when she selects gender dysphoria, it comes with a promise of a remedy. It comes with you select gender dysphoria. All you have to do then is take testosterone, have your breasts cut off, and then you'll be prancing around on TikTok really happy and life will be wonderful. So it's not just the really bad behavior and disorder that you can select from the symptom pool. It comes with the tantalizing promise that this medical pathway will solve all your problems. And then the most tragic aspect of it is, of course, that you only find out that it's not the answer to your problems when you've got to the end. So when you have permanently altered your body, when you have had your healthy breasts removed, or you've taken testosterone, maybe lost your fertility, the sexual function, your ability to form intimate relationships, you only find out that that's not the solution because gender was never the problem in the first place when you get to the end of the path.
Do we have empirical evidence, and I know there's not much evidence on either side, I mean, because so many records are lost, but we have evidence to suggest that many transitioners are unhappy afterwards and want to detransition?
We have no actual hard evidence, simply precisely for what you say. Nobody does any follow-up. So this experiment has been going on, if we're talking about the child transition, the adolescent transition, it's been going on since, well, the 2000s, but probably kicked off and large scale since 2014. And yet no one has ever bothered to do any follow-up, any long-term follow-up. So we can't know what the actual regret rate is. However, the Dutch are the ones who unleashed this experiment upon us. Huh. And the Dutch have some data on the original cohort who went through puberty blockers, hormones, and surgeries. And there is a study that I'm not sure if it has even been published yet, where it shows, I'm trying to think how they worded it. They worded it, 27% of these people who are now average age 30, they were transitioned as teenagers, 27% find their infertility troublesome is how they worded it. Basically, that means 27% regret sacrificing their fertility as teenagers. But then there's more in there to suggest that the regret rate is higher. And that is, one of them was interviewed, they have some quotes in there. One of the young people said, I could regret my losing my fertility, but there's no point because I can't change anything.
Okay.
So it's a sort of, I think probably the regret is higher because 56% at that point wanted to have children. None of them can, okay? And not one of them took the option of fertility preservation as a teenager because teenagers they don't want kids. No. I was a 13-year-old girl once. If you had asked me if I wanted children, never in a million years. I mean, all the way from 12 years old, I'd say, to about 25, I would never, ever have wanted children. Mm. Absolutely, completely impossible. I turned 30, and honestly, it was like somebody flipped a switch inside me. I needed to have a baby right away. I had three children. I became a stay-at-home mother. I was breastfeeding and co-sleeping, and I transformed into a completely different person, because that's what people typically do. That's a totally normal trajectory that we are taking away from these young people. So, yeah. Of course, there's regret.
There's also the cognitive biases involved in, like, a sunk cost fallacy, right? We've gone this far, I might as well tell myself I'm happy with it. And then the fear of having to go back and say I'm not happy. I've heard that's a big thing. I think it was the Cass report. People didn't want to go back and say I'm not happy with what's happened, because they feared the consequences.
Well, I mean, they don't want to go back to the clinic, to the doctors who harmed them, typically. It's actually probably really traumatizing to face the people who did this to you. But you're right, the sunk cost fallacy. I mean, if the more difficult it is to achieve something, the more you put into achieving something, the more likely you are to convince yourself that it was the right decision, the power of irrevocability. You can't turn back the clock. So this is, this can be for the most trivial of things. There's the famous study where they had people, they separated into two groups, and they just had to go through this sort of initiation to get into a group. And one group had to, you know, read a few things, words from a dictionary, and the other group had to read really sexually explicit passages, and it was really embarrassing and awful. And then they would then listen to a recording of the group that they were supposed to get into, and they deliberately, the researchers made the recording absolutely abysmal, dreadful. And so the ones who had gone through nothing to get in instantly said, this is dreadful, we're not joining this group, this is awful. The ones who'd gone through the really embarrassing experience listened to this dreadful recording and said, oh yeah, it's pretty good. We're into it. Like, that guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So it's when you have put a lot into something, or you've gone through an embarrassing situation, or you've gone through an arduous task to get into, to achieve a goal, you are powerfully psychologically motivated to, you want to have made the right decision. Nobody wants to admit that they've made a mistake. So imagine you've put your body parts into something. You've put your fertility, you've put your ability to form intimate relationships into something because you thought you wanted it, and you told everyone that it was exactly what you wanted and it was exactly what you needed. Then you get it and it's not what you want. That's why self-report, all of these studies that say transgender people, they're all happy with their, you know, like, we asked 90,000 transgender people if they were happy and they all said yes, so gender transition is amazing. You can't do that. Self-report is not an accurate measure of whether or not this treatment protocol is safe and beneficial.
So because what would be?
You've got to look at life situation. You've got to look at something other than self-report. So how is this person actually doing? What are their mental health issues? Do they have a stable relationship? Do they have, are they in employment? Are they in school? What are the real life outcomes? What physical health as well? Nobody is paying attention to the physical health of these people. They are, you know, are they thriving? Are they healthy? Are they mentally healthy? Don't just ask them if they're happy. They are powerfully psychologically motivated to say, yes, I'm happy, even if dealing with the most horrendous side effects, and even if they're lonely and can't form intimate relationships, they're still going to say, I don't regret it, because otherwise, imagine having to admit that to yourself.
Man, how did you come to be involved in, and to, I mean, did you, how does one say it? You did the WPATH files?
I did. I wrote the WPATH files report. Well, so I was writing for Michael Schellenberger, and almost immediately after he hired me, he got his hands on the WPATH files. I don't know who the source or the source is or who the sources are. If it's more than one person, I'm not sure. And so immediately, as soon as I was writing about gender, he got the WPATH files. And then we tried to turn the contents into a series of articles, but that didn't work out very well. We tried many times, didn't work out. So then he moved me over to Environmental Progress, which is his think tank. And that's where I got to do a really deep, in-depth report about the World Professional Association for Transgender Health.
And was it found that doctors sometimes either knew or were just sort of negligent in caring that the children that they were changing irrevocably, is that the word, didn't entirely know what they were going through?
Well, there's all sorts of contents in the files. So, yeah, the children aspect of it was quite, I mean, most of that comes from this panel discussion. It was a leaked video that we've got, and it's basically an endocrinologist, a child psychologist, a couple of therapists, and there's always the random non-medical person in all of these conversations. And so there's like a human rights lawyer or something, he's in there, she, I should say. And so, yeah, they're in that conversation. It's really quite chilling because the endocrinologist is a Canadian endocrinologist who has been putting young
people. What's an endocrinologist?
Hormones. They'll deal with, you know, the prior to gender madness, they would treat diabetes, I guess, childhood diabetes. Not really sure what other endocrinological problems a child would have. Like children, pediatric endocrinology is, I'm not sure what other.
Okay, so they were there. And what were you going to say? Sorry, before I interrupted.
Right, so this guy, he puts adolescents onto this treatment pathway. Bear that in mind when I tell you what he was talking about. So he was saying, they're talking about the difficulties of explaining puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and the sterility, the loss of fertility to children, basically. It's really difficult to explain this to children because they haven't even had high school biology. He says that. We're explaining these things to people who haven't even had high school biology yet. And then he says, it's always good in theory to talk to a 14-year-old about fertility preservation, but I know I'm talking to a blank wall. And he's like, they'll say, ooh, baby's gross, which is, like we just talked about, totally normal adolescent response. And then he is actually the one who was talking about the Dutch study and the 27% fertility regret. And he says, you know, there's the Dutch have a new study and it shows there's significant regret. And I don't think that surprises any of us. And then he says, I know there's regret because I see it in my patients. They come back to me in their early 20s and they've met someone and they want to settle down. And he says, I say to them, oh, the dog's not doing it for you anymore, is it? Meaning, you know, they were 14, 15, they thought they'd always be happy with a dog, right? Because they're 14 or 15. Mm-hmm. And then they get into their 20s, they've met someone, they want to settle down. And this man, who probably was the one who sterilized them, says to them, oh, the dog's not doing it for you anymore, wow. Is it? And so, yeah, that's the child angle. And one of the worst parts is the way WPATH members talk about detransition. So I understand that detransitioners create an awful lot of cognitive dissonance for WPATH members because they are the living proof that gender-affirming care sometimes harms. And when WPATH members are confronted with the existence of detransitioners, they do a few tricks, one of which is to just downplay the harm, just trivialize it. They'll say, oh, it's just another step on the gender journey, you know, as if it's no big deal. No mistake has been made. It's just another step on the gender journey. But then Marcy Bowers, and that's the president of WPATH, Marcy Bowers is in there saying, these young people, they have to own and take active responsibility for their choices, especially if they are permanent medical decisions. So what's going on there is Bowers is just completely putting the blame on the victim and failing to realize that he is the president of an organization that for the last, I'd say, two decades has relentlessly campaigned to remove all of the guardrails, all of the safeguarding from the field of gender medicine. They removed its transition on demand. Medical transition is a human right. Therefore, you don't need these psychological assessments. You shouldn't try and do psychotherapy to help the young person. You don't even dig into why the young person has come to this conclusion. None of that is allowed because that's all transphobic. Bowers is the head of the organization that campaigned to remove all the guardrails. Oh. And then a whole bunch of innocent young people came stumbling along, tumbled into the abyss, got their bodies irreparably damaged. And then at the end of it, Bowers says, well, it's your fault. You've got to own and take active responsibility.
It's children. These are children.
You know what? I mean, it's terrible what they're doing to children, but I don't sit in that camp of adults can do whatever they want. I think it's an absolute crime the way WPATH and gender-affirming clinicians treat adults. Adults need guardrails too. And so vulnerable adults are also tumbling into the abyss. Yeah. They're also coming to terrible harm because WPATH took away all the safeguarding and all the guardrails.
That's true.
Achieve clean, healthy-looking skin with Youth to the People. The 20-time award-winning superfood cleanser gently deep cleanses and removes makeup and SPF in 30 seconds for skin that's hydrated, balanced, and soothed, never stripped. It's the green juice cleanse for your face, formulated with good-for-you antioxidants like kale, spinach, and multivitamins to respect your barrier. No disruption. Find out why one cleanser is sold every minute in the U.S. Shop now at Sephora.
What's the craziest part?
Without question, the craziest part of the WPATH files is all of the discussions about non-binary surgeries. So people think non-binary is just blue hair and they, them pronouns, right? But it's not. There's a surgical side to this.
What?
And so they're talking about it in the WPATH files. There's a surgeon in there who's saying how comfortable he is creating second sets of genitals. So if you're a man and you identify as non-binary, but non-binary being, I guess, both male and female, then you could opt to keep your penis and then have a surgically created vagina.
No.
Out of a section of your colon.
What?
Right. So they would take... I'll come back to this in a sec. So they're talking about this in the WPATH files. This horror show has actually been brought to life in Canada. So we've got this case of... It's a man, exactly what I just described. He's a man and he has a feminine identity and he uses, he's non-binary, but with feminine dominant identity or something like that. And so he wanted to keep his penis and have a surgically created vagina out of a section of his colon. And in Ontario that we have, you know, healthcare is covered. The Ontario Health basically said, no way, we're not paying for that. And so he appealed. And when he appealed, his case rested upon the argument that forcing a non-binary person to go through binary surgery is a form of conversion therapy under Canada's conversion therapy ban.
Oh.
And remarkably, the appeal board ruled in his favor. And one of the reasons the appeal board ruled in his favor is because WPATH has an entire chapter in its latest Standards of Care, which is the Standards of Care 8, came out in September 2022. They have a whole chapter on non-binary, and it details, you know, penis-preserving vaginoplasty is what I was just talking about. There can be the other option of if a woman identifies as both male and female, and she wants to have, you know how they make a fake penis? They strip the skin from the forearm.
Or and the then, shin?
Thigh. No, thigh, it's it? Thigh. It's either the thigh or the forearm, and then they fashion it into an appendage sausage. That looks like, yeah, a sausage-like shape, sew it onto her groin, and, you know, then she's a man like any other, supposedly. But normally when they do that, they actually remove the vagina and all the internal reproductive organs. But if she's a woman who identifies as both male and female, then she gets to keep her vagina as well as having her arm flesh appendage sewn onto her groin. These are the non-binary surgeries. So this man got approval, the appeal board ruled in his favor and said, yes, the province should pay. And then the province appealed that decision, and it's still ruled in the guy's favor. And so the Ontario taxpayer will pay for this man to go down to Texas, because we don't do those surgeries in Canada. We're going to pay for him to go down to Texas to have his colon vagina made at a very, very dubious gender clinic in Texas.
Christ.
But in the WPATH files, they're talking about these surgeries. And this, you know, this doctor is infamous for doing these surgeries. But nobody in the files questions, should we be doing this? You know, they actually use the phrase, creating body types that do not exist in nature. No one's in there asking whether this is the right thing to do, whether this is ethically right. All they're doing is policing each other's language, suggesting that, you know, calling it a non-binary surgery is cis-normative language.
Oh my
because
God.
Maybe somebody who is binary will want to have the non-binary surgery. Or someone says, well, we can't call them non-standard because one day they might become standard. That's actually the head of the Nottingham Gender Clinic who says that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
Nottingham, home of Britain's only Hooters.
Oh, is it really? Yeah. Is there a connection?
Not linking
there?
Those two people,
not
but
not sure if there's, you know, a connection.
That's insane. But this person you're talking about is clearly mentally ill and needs help.
The one in Ontario is absolutely, most certainly mentally ill. And I think anyone who wants a second set of genitals is by definition mentally ill, bringing us back to where we were at the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah.
We've got to, I think we can't be afraid of calling mental illness mental illness. And I think it's the first step in helping these people is recognizing that they have a mental illness and that they need psychotherapeutic support, not a second set of genitals.
I think this is a really good episode, because I think a lot of people might have balked at the way you described it as mental illness at the start. And I think a lot of people will have come round to being at least more comfortable with that term towards the end. I've got another question to ask you, but where do you want to send people? Where can people find your work and follow you?
I'm only active on Twitter. Sorry, I can't help it. I have to call it Twitter.
Yeah.
So my handle is @_CryMiaRiver. Mia is MIA.
Yep. Justin Timberlake. Cry Me a River.
Does he?
It's a song. You don't know the song?
I don't know the song.
You don't have to say what you did. I already know. I found out from. You know the song?
I still do not know the song, yeah. I'm afraid.
Usually I could hit that note, but my cough.
Is that the chorus? No, you got to sing the chorus if you want me to.
Okay.
But I assume it's not Mia, M-I-A. It's Cry Me a River.
No, that would be weird.
That would be very weird.
Yeah, it's supposed to be about Britney Spears.
Oh, really?
I think. It was like 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Okay, yeah. Never heard it.
Okay, but people should follow you @CryMeaRiver, Mia.
@CryMeaRiver, _ Cry Me a River. Mm-hmm. I'm still writing for Michael Schellenberger's think tank. I have another research project in the works, but that's going to be a few months before that comes out.
Fantastic. Who is a heretic that you admire?
Right, this is actually the only question that I was given beforehand because, so that I could prepare. And when I read it, I instantly, the person I'm going to name jumped into my mind. And then I spent a few days thinking, oh, it's so predictable. But then I realized I'd be lying if I said anyone else. So my answer is J.K. Rowling. And the reason for that, okay, so first of all, this is the woman who brought magic into my children's lives, right? I can't imagine my children's childhoods without the magic of Harry Potter. And, you know, we read the stories, bedtime stories, every night for years and years and years. And so the characters in Harry Potter, they're so real and they're so human and they're so courageous and they stand up for what's right, even when it's difficult to do so. And so the fact that the author is every bit as courageous as the amazing characters that she created is obviously, it's just so, it's when your heroes are actually as heroic mm-hmm. as you hold them up to be, it's a wonderful thing. And it's also because she knew what she was stepping into, okay? Like she didn't have to do this. She didn't have to take a public stand on this issue. And yet she did, knowing, I'm sure she knew what the backlash was going to be. And still she did it, and she did it because it's important, but also she just does it with such eloquence. She just does it so beautifully. She writes so eloquently, and she's also really funny. She injects so much humor into it. So there's no one for whom I have greater respect.
A wonderful heretic. Thank you, Mia Hughes. What did you guys all think? Let me know. You can sort of reply on Spotify. You can also get me on X, formerly Twitter, AndrewGold_OK. Come and say what you think is happening and all of that stuff. I often reply. Please do get hold of my book, The Psychology of Secrets, and even review it, if you could, on amazon.co.uk. I read all the reviews. They all make me very happy when they're good reviews anyway. And follow Mia on _CrimeaRiver on X and get sort of tweeting at her because she is fully deserving of it. She's a wonderful speaker, and I hope that was really, really interesting for you guys. I'll see you next time.